We'll call the Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors to order this morning, being a little after 9 a.m. on February the 5th, 2020. Laura, would you lead us in the pledge, please?
Our pledge is to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
April, we have some guests this morning, please.
Yes, we have our team from Vanscoyac. Pete and Jeff are here, as well as Aaron Mella with Mella Poppet.
Wonderful. Welcome. Okay, agenda item one is reserved for public comments. It's any subject within the jurisdiction of EMWD and is not on today's agenda is welcome to speak. I see no one raising their hands and no cards. Paul, can we get the executive report, please?
Sure. Morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. My written report is in your board package. Want to update you on several things. First, on January 29th, we had a follow-up meeting with the executive management team at Western Municipal Water District regarding the Paris North Groundwater Project Partnership. We were continuing negotiations on our proposed terms and conditions and had prepared a term sheet that we submitted to Western in advance of the meeting. I'm happy to report, I thought, and Joe attended the meeting with me, it was very productive. Really, the issues that they raised on the term sheet were clarifications of intent on certain terms and conditions, no substantive changes on the terms, and also some potential implementation matters, such as the point of connections and phasing in the points of connections for the water from the project. So we're very pleased with the outcome of that meeting. We are refining the term sheet. We will meet with them again. Shayla is scheduling a meeting on our behalf. And then once we get a term sheet established, we'll very quickly draft a project participation agreement with Western. And our goal is to get that to legal counsel and the board for its consideration within the next couple of months. So good news there. Some past and ongoing activities. I'd like to give the board a brief update on the Marietta Division-focused Municipal Services Review. Their progress is continuing on that report. The LAFCO has retained, as I've mentioned earlier, an outside consultant to an independent third-party consultant to do a review of the Marietta Division and see if Western, Eastern, or Rancho would be a preferred provider based on costs and levels of service. West Yost has been hired by the LAFCO, and they have a sub-consultant, FG Solutions, who they're working with on the financial analysis. West Yost has developed the infrastructure requirements that would be in place for each of the three agencies to not only serve existing development but future development, and that varies by the agencies because of the proximity of our existing infrastructure. We provided some additional guidance to the consultant on how those costs would be allocated and between new development and existing customers, and also on the financing mechanisms that we offer and deploy to recover costs. That information was put together in a financial model modeled for each of the agencies what costs would be, and this was done by FG Solutions. As I mentioned earlier, they're the sub-consultant to West Yost. And on January 23rd, we had a meeting with FG Solutions where we had a chance to go through that detailed financial model with them and provide feedback. It was a good meeting. There was some inaccuracies in that model that we were able to correct, and Charles and his staff went through it in detail. We also provided them some additional data that they felt was very helpful. They had similar meetings with Rancho and Western. And really, the next steps are going to be for the final version of the model to be redistributed to the agencies for us to give it kind of a final okay. And then in parallel with that, West Yost will be drafting the study in draft form. There will be community meetings held before the draft study is then subsequently brought to the LAFCO Commission for consideration. The current schedule being put forth by the LAFCO staff is for the process now to be completed in late spring or even early summer. So they're looking at a few months out for the final process. We did have a meeting with Western and Rancho management on this, and Gary Thompson, the executive director of LAFCO, to kind of go through the final process. I will say it was interesting in the meeting. Western has now retained an outside lobbying consultant to help with the LAFCO Commission, and that's John Withers from California Strategies. And so he was in attendance in the meeting. So they are obviously going to be working with the LAFCO Commission on this. So that's kind of the latest schedule, and we'll continue to brief the board. Items of interest, the Groundwater Sustainability Act, Eastern is the GSA, or Groundwater Sustainability Agency, for the West San Jacinto Basin. We're required to put together a GSP, or Groundwater Sustainability Plan, under state law. That plan is going to look at our brackish desalination program, our current and proposed contamination remediation projects, our water supply management and monitoring programs that we do in the basin. Recently, Department of Water Resources announced a solicitation for potential grants that we could use to do that. We did apply with our very able grant staff, and we were recently notified that we received a grant for the preparation of that study for $1.67 million. So we're very pleased with that, and that's going to, of course, save our ratepayers some money for this obligation. On our Santa Ana River Conservation and Conjunctive Use Project, I want to give the board a brief update on that. As you recall, the principal element of that project is a watershed-wide groundwater banking program that provides about 144,000 acre-feet of dry year storage in six locations throughout the Santa Ana River watershed, including 19,500 acre-feet of storage in the San Jacinto Basin. Programs funded partially by a $55 million grant from Proposition 84, and the source water for the program includes surplus state water project water that would be made available from San Bernardino Valley Municipal Water District. To implement the project requires two very complex agreements. One between Metropolitan and San Bernardino Valley Municipal Water District to be able to procure the surplus water, and then another between all of the MET member agencies who are participating in the program and MET to allow some in-lieu exchanges to give us pricing assurances on the water and how much water we would get and under what circumstances and so forth. So these are very, as I mentioned, detailed and complex agreements. The reason there has to be two agreements is San Bernardino Valley Municipal Water District is a separate state water project contractor. So it is not authorized under the state water project for them to sell us water directly. They have to sell the water to MET, and then MET has to sell the water to us to not violate the state water project contract. So in late December, the MET executive staff agreed to the terms and conditions of our agreement, the MET member agency's agreement on SARCUP. We had a general manager's meeting to finalize those terms yesterday. I'm pleased to report that went very, very well. We have reviewed not only the final terms and conditions, but with Steve's support, we developed a draft agreement that was modeled under some other metropolitan agreements for water banking. That was distributed to the agencies, and we were able to get them to commit to a schedule to bring that agreement to their boards by April. That will then allow Metropolitan to take the agreements, the agreement with Valley and the agreement with the SARCUP agencies, to their board in June. And so this is progressing very well. I do want to say in the meeting yesterday, the other agencies recognize our team for putting the agreements together and negotiating this very complex deal with Metropolitan, and particularly Brian Powell, Linnea, and Leanne Kirk, who worked so hard on this, and the other agencies recognize us for doing that work. So with that concludes my report. Are there any questions?
When what's the timeline for the review of the financial stuff for the Murrieta division?
I would say we just gave that information back to the consultant. I would estimate, and Joe, you can weigh in here, there's probably going to be another 3 to 4 weeks before they turn that model around. They would then give us the version of the model again for us to take one more look at it. And then I think after they do that, have that process, they will start to put the draft report together. Joe, do you think that's about the schedule?
Yes, and as Paul mentioned, they're meeting with each individual water agency to make sure we're all comfortable with the financial model that represents the service scenario. In talking to Gary Thompson again, there will be another public workshop to share the results of the focused MSR. He's thinking it may be somewhere between the May timeframe. So this is going to take a few more months to wrap up.
I think the good thing is, and we spoke this in our meeting with Rancho yesterday, we had our ad hoc committee meeting, is LAFCO is taking the time, and their consultants are taking the time to make sure the modeling and the scenarios, their service scenarios they're looking at are accurate.
Sure.
And so I think we can stand behind that, even if it does take a little more time.
Sure.
Any further questions? Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Laura.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention SB998, the shutoff bill, became effective on February 1st this week. Our program is up and running. So our customer service reps are ready to take any calls and answer any questions. They're really trained. Our computer systems are up to date and ready to handle the new regulations. And our website, EMWD Assist, is available to our customers to sign up for the program. I just want to thank our customer service group, PGA, and our IS group. It's a pretty heavy lift over a very short period of time with many projects going on. So I commend them for their work in getting it implemented timely and really sharing our story with many other agencies that have kind of been struggling with information as well. So I just want to let you know that we probably bring back periodic reports if anything crazy happens with our financials. You know, always people start signing up for it. But right now, the first week is really quiet. And so we haven't had any hits or any hits on the website that I've heard of, and we haven't received any phone calls.
All right. Don't jinx it.
Yeah.
That's my report.
Nick.
Yeah, just one update. I think you're aware, for quite some time now, we've been looking at the ability to acquire additional drying line capacity associated with our Paris 2 desalter, the additional capacity, specifically treatment capacity. And Joe Muad and myself, we've been doing the rounds, meeting with some other member agencies that have capacity in the drying line, i.e. UA, Western. We've actually sat down with Orange County Sand District to look at what the requirements would be to purchase additional capacity there. We've coordinated with SAPA. There's some possibilities. And just coincidentally, it couldn't have worked out better. You're aware that the Inland Empire Energy Center is decommissioned. They're going through a process of constructing that facility. They've sold that off future users, battery storage, and they have no need for their capacity that they have under agreement with us. And they've elected to terminate the agreement, and then that capacity now reverts back to us if we have it available. So, long story short, things worked out really, really well, and they have about 1.2 million gallons of capacity in that line is going to revert to us, and so we have no need to acquire any additional capacity. It's a good result.
Yeah, that reversion was at no cost to the district.
Yeah,
that's great. And just FYI, if we were to purchase additional capacity from Orange County Sand District, their rate right now is about 6.8 million.
Yeah. wonderful.
It was a good meal.
Yeah.
We're very pleased.
Joe worked it really well. Joe actually coordinating with operations and maintenance as well. They just kind of bided their time until all of a sudden it worked out well for everybody.
And just as a note, I countersigned the agreement this morning, so it's in place.
Wonderful.
Excellent.
Okay. Good job. Joe.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the board. Just a couple of quick updates. Last week, we had a meeting with the Saboba Tribal Administrator. They are interested in potentially acquiring EMWD property at the intersection of the Lona Expressway and Lakefront Drive. Specifically, this would be Catty Corner from Saboba's Luciano project, or Luciano Village project. The interest is to potentially install a sign for the Saboba Resort at that location. So they will be coming back to us with a more defined request. In parallel, we will be looking at doing an appraisal for that property. And so once we have key terms and agreement on those terms, we will be bringing that back to the board for consideration. On a separate matter, in working with Public Government Affairs, we've coordinated a tour for this Saturday for the Kalpala Kahuna Engineering Department. And we've got a great response. We have 87 students and faculty that have confirmed to come out this Saturday for a tour of our facilities, including the Salters, our reclamation plant at Paris, and our filtration plant. So we're really excited about hosting the Kalpala Kahuna Engineering Service.
Just so it's going to kick off at the desalter?
No, here. We're going to start.
I'm going to start here.
Opening session here in the boardroom, I believe at
9 o'clock.
Okay.
9 o'clock, yes.
I don't have a real calendar yet at home, so so I was trying
President
to figure
Sullivan
out.
Has computer challenges.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll be here. Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Just real quickly. So I'll ask me to get the board to replicate on the biofilter project across the street.
Oh, yeah.
This jar is what the media looks like, engineering, synthetic media. So if you recall, Matt brought this to the board asking approval to pre-purchase that media, and we came back to the board again to award a contract to Genesis Construction. So I would like to give you a brief update of how that project's going and help explain kind of what you're seeing over there as you drive into the office if you go that way over to 215. So back in December 11th, the board authorized the project. It was a biofilter media replacement. The existing media is an organic tree bark and tree wood material that has decayed rather rapidly, kind of a function of the biology within the cell, the fact that you have to have water, and it just didn't hold up like we had hoped. So we awarded a contract to Genesis Construction, or also known as Hammett Manufacturing, in the amount of $869,000. Total project, including the purchase of the media and staff labor and contractor labor, is almost $2.3 million. So Genesis mobilized on the 13th of January, and they're actively out there working. But by way of background, the main reason for the project was the deterioration of the media, the fact that the foul air could not flow evenly through the media, is being impeded by the decayed material, and so we got a very uneven distribution, and it was really starting to fail for its primary function. So this is just an aerial photo of the biofilter, and just to kind of give you a reason of the scale of the thing, it's almost a whole acre of media, about to depth of three and a half feet, 194 feet by 194 feet. And just by comparison, see a semi-tractor trailer there on the 215, again, just to give you the scale of this biofilter. So the contractor is actively out there working. They've removed all of the old media from the first cell. There's four cells in the biofilter. And the media that's been removed, again, it's like a soil-type material now. It's being stored on our property and will be applied by our tenant farmer to our land, which is currently a hay field operation. So it's good nutrients for the hay field. And we're having that done at a very beneficial rate for Eastern versus the last project 3 years ago where we were hauling it off-site. So that's helped us keep our expenses down. The media, as you see in the jar there, it's a very small rock-type material. It's actually impregnated with some nutrients to kind of help kick it off. and it's got some other applications to make it last longer, to stand the low pH condition that it goes into. And we're told it's going to last, I think, 20 years, Matt, is that right? 20 to 30 years, maybe. So we're hoping for the longer period of that than the shorter. It was shipped by sea to the port of Los Angeles. Went all the way around. I'm not sure if it went around the Horn or went through the Panama Canal. But it was 60 different containers. And you can see by the two images, those are two different piles. It's 2,400 super sacks. And that's not all of the media on site yet. So just to give you an idea of the scale of the project, it's a lot of material that has to be put into place. So the lava rock has been also removed all the way down to the top of the, or to the point where we exposed the air distribution laterals. See in this photo here, the laterals have been separated. It's in Genesis scope that they are to clean the pores or the holes. There's thousands of 3/8 inch diameter holes in those laterals that have, as shown, see on the picture on the right, that have scaled up with the material that we believe is a function of the acid breaking down the media and the lava rock and the cell. So we're also working on ways to devise methods to clean those pores without taking the media out. So we're thinking into it with a combination of the vacuum trap, possibly a chemical solution that we would do maybe once every year or two to keep those pores open and allowing the air to flow into the filter.
Although hopefully with the new media not breaking down like the previous media did, we will not see that plugging in those holes. So we're going to be monitoring that. But again, this media is completely different. Being a synthetic media, it shouldn't have the breakdown that we saw in the case with the previous media, the clogging.
Are the holes all the way around?
No, they're just on the kind of in the bottom. I believe it's like the 5 o'clock and the 7 o'clock position. So the water kind of dribbles around the pipe, and then with the air coming out, normally should be pushing it away. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. So that's it. If you have any more questions, which, again, if you drive by there, you can see a ton of activity. And like, oh my God, all that, all those sets. It's kind of surprising to see them all stacked out there. And like, wow, that's a big job. It kind of explains the cost that we've seen associated with this product. It seems very simple, but it's a lot going on there. So. You know, if you have any questions, feel free to call me. I know it's important to us to do our best to be a good neighbor to everybody in the community, and this control of the odors from this Fowler filter are extremely critical from our perspective. So.
Jeff, we're doing one at a time, right? So
yes.
Three are operating, we do one.
Correct.
Okay.
And if you recall, Matt had budgeted for three of the four cells. This media is much more efficient, and by looking at the airflow rates for the design of the original biofilter, we've determined that we can treat all of the flow, even up to like the full plant capacity with just three of the four cells. So we can eventually go back into the four cell and put more media in there, but we don't anticipate doing that for at least a decade.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Great report.
Yeah. You bet. Okay. With that, we'll go to the consent calendar, agenda item 3. I understand that Director Corona needs to abstain on D. So I'll accept a motion and a second for items 3A through C.
I'll move the item.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously with Director Record absent.
Okay. It's my understanding that Director Corona may have a potential conflict on item D, and he will be removing himself from the dais for the board's consideration of this item.
Okay, I'll accept a motion and a second for 3D.
I'll move 3D.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Record absent and Director Corona off the dais. Okay, we'll go to agenda item 4, which is the action calendar. Number A, to approve an authorized award of contract with Lead Electric Incorporated for $2,257,000 for the Apollo lift station electrical system upgrade. An additional appropriation of $3,357,400. Joe.
Good morning again. As the board is aware, that the Paul Lift Station serves our Temecula service area, collects wastewater from the surrounding area next to the Pechanga Resort, including the Pechanga Resort, and conveys that wastewater to our Temecula reclamation plant for treatment. The exhibit here shows the location of the facility. The facility was constructed in 1991, and the electrical components are reaching end of useful life. The components include the motor control center, the variable frequency drives for the pumps, as well as the switch gear, automatic pressure switch, and the components of the HVAC system. As part of this project, we also desire to mitigate the risks associated with the electrical arc flash. Thus, we will be relocating certain components outside of the building and addressing that concern. So the scope of the work includes providing new electrical switch gear and automatic thruster switch, which will be located outside of the existing control facility or control building. The new FCC will be within the existing building. All the pumps will be equipped with new VFDs. We are also working closely with Edison. They will be upgrading the electrical transformer on site. There's also other miscellaneous work, including relocation of the communication tower. Some of the work that has to be completed will require bypassing the facility. Thus, a significant aspect of this is to put in temporary pumps to bypass the flow so we can replace the electrical components. Last year in May, we completed the bid documents. We went out to bid, and in August, we received bids. However, during review of those bid results, we recognized that several of the contractors who bid the job did not have the necessary experience in electrical system improvements. Thus, we elected to reject those bids, and we undertook a pre-qualification process where we pre-qualified contractors that then would be invited to bid on this effort. So the pre-bid was completed recently. In fact, we got bids in December. We were very pleased with the results. The lowest bid was received from Lead Electric at approximately $2.25 million. That is approximately 12% or 11% below the engineer's estimate. I should note that the bid from Lead is, in fact, approximately $40,000 less than the previous bid exercise that we undertook last year in August. So it's very consistent, and we're pleased with the results. In addition to recommending an award contract to Lead for the construction, we will need continued support from the engineering firm, Spec Services. They are the engineer of record. They will support us with the review of submittals, change orders. They will also provide an electrical inspector to help us inspect the work as it progresses on site. And they will also assist us with testing, startup, and preparation of operation and maintenance plan. In terms of schedule, upon board consideration and approval of this item today, we will issue the notice to proceed this month. It's approximately 1 year of construction to complete this project. So our recommendation is to award a construction contract to Lead and, again, continue the services of Spec Services during construction. And, of course, we're asking for the additional appropriation to fund this project to construction completion. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Do you have any questions, Joe?
I have no questions.
Okay. Well,
second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Record absent. And so that folks in the audience know, Director Record is not here today because he's actually meeting with the governor, along with Gloria Gray and probably Jeff Keitlinger in Sacramento. And so it just tells you a little bit of the influence that EMWD has in Sacramento. So anyway, we'll go to agenda item B. Eric.
Good morning. This is the Temecula Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility hot water boiler installation project. I'm glad it's a cold day today because it reminds us that for our facilities to continue to operate and maintain solid stabilization, we do need to have a reliable heat source. This presentation will put some information on the background, a summary of bids for construction that we recently received, an engineering service contract for services during construction, and a recommendation. Again, the site that we were focusing on this morning is the Temecula Valley RWRF site. As you may recall, under the Boral Electrification Project, we have been removing our engines from our RWF sites and replacing them with electric-driven motor-driven blowers. And this is removing an important heat source in the Temecula site for maintaining solid stabilization. And to maintain the same level of service reliability, we are now in a position where we need to install natural gas boilers. And this project will support that effort and to maintain reliable service for a solid stabilization. The photo shows you a photo of one of the engine-driven blowers that's being removed from the site, and that heat source is no longer available. This project, the design of it, was recently completed under the Temecula Valley Digester Gas Beneficial Use Project, but we wanted to implement this as an expedited project, so we administratively approved an appropriation amount of $53,800 to advance the project as a separate project from that effort. And the images on this slide show you that we are installing two boilers. On the right, you see the two green boilers that are being installed. Those are 2 million BTU output boilers each. There's an existing 1.5 million BTU boiler that's on site, and there's an existing pad and canopy. So this project will install the mechanical components for the boilers, the interconnecting piping. Each of these boilers, the new boilers, come with individual Honeywell controllers. And then we will also be installing a master control panel consisting of compact logic to integrate the system. So it's not just boilers, it's a boiler system for the site. To accomplish that, we also have to replace the existing control module for the existing boiler to upgrade that to allow communication with the SCADA. We advertised the project in November. We received three bids. The bid range is actually pretty good. So it reflects that the contractors looked at this project and saw somewhat the project in the same way. SCW, who currently is mobilized to the site, came in with a slightly lower bid than the other two. The bid is actually roughly about 8% below the engineer's estimate. We believe this is a good value for this project. Jacobs performed the engineering design for this project. We negotiated a fee in the amount of roughly $99,000 for engineering services during construction, including field supports, middle reviews, responses to clarifications and change orders, technical and special inspection, record drawings, as well as electronic O&Ms at the completion of the project. Our schedule, design is complete. This calendar suggests it's going to be done in January, but we're looking actually to a notice to proceed in February, assuming the board approves, and substantial completion by October, which would be ahead of the next winter season. Recommendation, award of contract to SCW in the amount of $1,566,000. Execution of the engineering service contract with Jacobs in the amount of $99,977. Admin award of contracts necessary to complete the project, and an appropriation in the amount of $2,176,277, bringing the total project cost to approximately $2.2 million. I'm available to answer questions at this time.
Do you have any questions of Eric?
I'll move the item.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Record absent. 4C is to approve and authorize agreements for as-needed environmental emissions source testing services in the full term, not to exceed a total of $350,000.
Thank you, Sullivan, President Sullivan. For consideration by the board this morning is a recommendation to enter into two of our standard as-needed support agreements. This is for emissions source testing that is a function that is managed by our Environmental and Regulatory Compliance Department. This will replace two existing as-needed agreements that expire on February 29th. We follow our standard process by issuing requests for qualifications. We had a good response for this solicitation. We received five proposals, and two of the firms are being recommended for a contract award for the upcoming 2 years. The scope of services primarily revolves around emission source testing of internal combustion engines, some of those boilers that Eric just spoke to, as well as the flares at our wastewater treatment plant. There are required protocols for annual testing and submission of reports to the Air Quality Management District.
to ensure compliance with our operational assets out there. That's the primary scope of these contracts. The evaluation team evaluated the five proposals that were received based on our standard criteria, qualifications and experience, pricing, local presence of the firms, the criteria that we generally use for these evaluations of as-needed agreements. And again, the two firms selected are Horizon Air Measurement Services of Camarillo. They are an incumbent provider, as well as Air Kinetics of Anaheim. They are a new contractor to our as-needed list. The expenditures over the past 2 years of the existing contracts have been approximately $315,000. ERC staff anticipate similar expenditures over the next 2 years, and we're recommending $350,000, up to $350,000 over the two-year term, the recommended two-year term. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Dan?
I'll move the item.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with director record absent. We'll go to agenda item 5, which is the information items. We'll go to the state and federal. Danielle, you want to lead us off, huh? All right.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. It's that time of year where we like to bring our state and federal advocates to you to hear from the boots on the ground on all the activities that we are gearing up to undertake. We have this nice little lull right now before things start heating up, and so this is a really good opportunity to see to hear from both our advocates on the trajectory that they see underway. Today we have Pete Evich with Van Skoyken and Associates, and he's brought Jeff Bowman. And then from our state advocate side, we have Aaron Namela with Namela Pappas. And I'm going to have our federal advocates go first, and then we'll turn it over to our state advocate. But feel free to ask questions in between the two presentations. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Pete.
Good morning. Thank you, Daniel. That is an introduction. I am President Sullivan, Directors Pauly, Corona, and Slauson, General Manager Jones. We certainly appreciate this opportunity to present to you today. And as Danielle had mentioned, we have Jeff Bowman from Van Skoyken Associates here with me. Jeff and I are the firm's main principals who work day-to-day to help advance EMWD's efforts in Washington, D.C. So, as it is widely known, the months-long congressional impeachment and trial process of President Trump will finally conclude later today. However, as evidenced by, I think, last night's State of the Union address, there are no indications that President Trump and congressional Democrats are currently offering each other olive branches to turn the proverbial page. So,
tear up the proverbial page.
So, yes, in short, the high-level outlook for 2020, unfortunately, is that rancor and partisanship will continue to run high, and election year politics will thwart any legislative deal-making on, you know, virtually all major policy issues. I would say, however, that the caveat to that could be the post-election lame duck session, as that is often when a flurry of legislative activity takes place. This was certainly the case in 2016 after President Trump was elected. The congressional Democrats at that time looked to get the best deal possible on a number of policy issues before a newly minted Trump administration took hold. So, again, the lame duck is, I think, will be probably of potentially of most interest in terms of substantive and tangible legislative activity. You know, throughout the year, we'll expect to see House Democrats pass a number of what we call aspirational or wish list measures, which will be essentially showpieces for not only their base, but as well as an effort to display to the electorate at large the policies that would be prioritized if voters ushered in a democratically controlled Senate and bring a new occupant into the White House in November. Outside of the kind of the legislative grandstanding you would see in a presidential election year, Congress will need to hunker down and tackle some important issues before the election season completely overcomes Washington in late July or early August. And highest on that list is the is making progress on the on advancing the 12 annual appropriations measures. Those are the bills which fund all government agencies and discretionary programs. For the appropriators, the silver lining this year is that the two-year budget agreement that Congress and the White House struck last July will result in a smoother start than last year. That agreement set in place a unified top-line spending level that both the House and Senate will have to adhere to as they draft their respective fiscal year 2021 spending bills. And aiding to the process is that the overall federal spending level for 2021 will represent a slight increase from current levels. As part of this process, EMWD will be advocating for the Congressional Appropriations Committees to adequately fund a number of key federal water programs. These are programs that the district has and will attempt to continue to access in the future, such as the Army Corps of Engineers Environmental Infrastructure Account, which funds the Paris DeSalter Project, the Bureau of Reclamation's Title 16, desalinization, and Water Spark grant programs, as well as EPA's state revolving fund accounts. Turning to the much ballyhooed word or phrase of an infrastructure package, given that the five-year federal surface transportation law is set to expire on September 30th, we're hearing, and you're likely hearing, federal infrastructure packages once again taking center stage. Last week, House Democrats rolled out a high-dollar $760 billion infrastructure proposal that includes multi-year funding for highway, rail, transit, water, broadband, clean energy, and climate resiliency initiatives. The water-related components of this proposal, which would be of most interest to EMWD, include $17 billion to capitalize the state revolving funds over the next 5 years, as well as the establishment of an EPA-administered nationwide water reuse and water recycling program. As for the Senate, Majority Leader McConnell has indicated he's preparing to bring to the floor sometime this spring a more modest $287 billion surface transportation measure. As it relates to these infrastructure packages, these large-scale infrastructure packages, neither the House nor the Senate have yet to settle on an approach as to how to pay for their respective infrastructure proposals. And as we won't see Congress enact a tax increase in an election year, look for lawmakers to enact a short-term extension of the existing highway law and punt away on comprehensive an infrastructure package until sometime next year. Another key water infrastructure measure, it's called the Water Resources Development Act, will begin to take shape in both the House and Senate in the coming months. While the primary objective of this bill is to authorize Army Corps of Engineer projects, this measure, over its last two iterations anyway, have served as an underlying vehicle for attaching EPA and Bureau of Reclamation water infrastructure provisions. For EMWD, this upcoming Water Resources Development Act is particularly important because the district is requesting specific language be included in the bill to double its existing Army Corps authorization from $25 million to $50 million related to the Paris II DeSalter and the overall desalinization program. So ultimately, if successful, this additional funding would be used to advance a third DeSalter in the district. We have been working closely with EMWD's congressional delegation and the committees of jurisdiction over the last several months to assist them in advocating for the inclusion of this language in the soon-to-be-developed House and Senate versions of the bill. Securing this language in the water bill will be one of EMWD's top priorities during its March advocacy trip. At the same time, EMWD continues to vie for annual Army Corps funding to complete the installation of the final Paris II desalter pipelines. Of the district's original $25 million authorization for this effort, $4.7 million in federal funding is what remains to be appropriated by the Corps. So for the current fiscal year, EMD has requested the full remaining amount of $4.7 million to complete the project. The Army Corps work plan, which is where this annual funding is released, is expected to come out sometime this month, so we'll soon know the funding level the Corps will be allocating. There are three key Bureau of Reclamation water, Western Water Grant programs which were created as part of the 2016 WIN Act. All three of those programs, unfortunately, however, are set to permanently expire in 2021 unless Congress takes action. Those three programs include a grant program for Western Water Storage Projects, the competitive Title 16 recycling program, and a program which funds desalinization projects in the 17 reclamation states. While several pieces of legislation have been introduced to reauthorize these critical water programs, the House and Senate bills take divergent approaches as to how they should be structured and funded moving forward. This divide reflects long-running and long-held philosophical policy disputes and approaches to addressing California water issues. At this point, it's hard to predict if compromise will ultimately come together before the end of the year, which will allow these programs to continue forward. If a larger deal is elusive, however, a possible option could be a one-year extension to defer consideration into next year. VSA, Vanscoyac Associates, Jeff and I have been working closely with Senator Feinstein's office, the House Natural Resources Committee, the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee staff on the reauthorization of these programs. We've also been working very closely with AQUA, Water Reuse, and other water stakeholder groups. Pressing for the congressional reauthorization of these important reclamation water programs will also be a priority agenda item during EMWD's March advocacy trip. Since the announcement by the California State Water Resources Control Board that Eastern was awarded a $36.3 million grant for the Paris North Basin Groundwater Project, we have once again been working closely with Congressman Calvert's office in an effort to re-engage Pentagon officials to brief them on this grant award and to seek the Air Force's cooperation and partnership on certain non-monetary elements necessary to advance the project. Toward this end, a meeting between EMWD representatives and Pentagon officials is set to take place on February 27th, and that will be in Washington, D.C. On the policy and regulatory front, federal legislation to address PFAS contamination has been a hot topic in D.C. And Eastern's advocacy efforts on this issue over the last year have been focused on raising concerns with certain proposals in Congress that would designate some or all PFAS chemicals as hazardous under the federal Superfund law. This designation would be problematic as it would place non-polluting water agencies in the funding liability laws chain stream. So the tussle over this particular Superfund issue has prevented major PFAS legislation from being enacted in this Congress. In the meantime, EPA is taking independent action, and we may see the agency move forward later this year with a regulation that could establish a maximum contamination limit for two specific PFAS chemicals, PFOA and PFOS. In 2020, EMWD will also continue to advocate for legislation that would amend the tax code to ensure that water conservation rebates are not considered taxable income. And of note on the regulatory side, the Trump administration recently released the revised final WOTUS rule. This has been a longstanding matter, as many will recall. The Obama administration had set forth its own WOTUS rule The courts have had stalled it from taking action, and the administration, the new administration, has put forth a revised and now a final version of the bill, which will be implemented in 60 days from its release last week. The good news on this is that our read of the final rule is that it clearly exempts water recycling structures and related construction ponds and ephemeral streams from the Clean Water Act regulations. The Trump administration has recently been issuing some major environmental regulations. We've seen revisions come out recently to the NEPA implementation rules as well as the Endangered Species Act. Lastly, EPA will be unveiling its finalized Water Reuse Action Plan on February 27th. General Manager Jones has been heavily involved in the drafting of this document and has been working closely with all the federal agencies and in his role with water reuse. And he will be coming to Washington, D.C. and presenting at this event on that date. So with that, my remarks have been concluded and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? When do you think WERDA will get up for something?
If I'm wrong, Jeff, correct me on this, but there's going to be we're going to there's some additional
Jeff
here.
Knows the exact date. I can tell.
Yeah, the reason I say that is Jeff was the in his former life was the staff director of the House subcommittee, which wrote the water bills. The end of this month, there's going to be continued hearings in the House. We'll see continued hearings in the Senate, but I think the schedule is for. Ultimately for the legislation and a markup on the House side to occur sometime, I would say, in April or May, with the Senate following suit probably closely around the same time.
Am I right in the ballpark on that, Jeff?
Okay. So it's coming soon. And so on the Senate side, last fall, they actually, the offices put a call for projects. The Committee of Jurisdiction asked all Senate offices to submit to the committee prioritized projects within their state. In that process, we worked closely with Senator Feinstein and Harris's office to submit all the necessary and required information to them related to the additional $25 million authorization increase we're requesting. You know, we are positioned well in terms of the material information they presented to the Senate, and we're working closely with all our House members, Representatives Calvert, Takano, and Ruiz on the House side as well.
Pete, could you also talk a little bit? This modification to our authorization is very important. It provides us another potential for another $25 million. Would be used primarily for brine treatment technologies that we're considering at the desalters, as well as for actually enhancing the infrastructure to bring water into the plants and so forth. So can you talk also and let the board know about not only the interface with the congressional offices, but what we've been doing in terms of interfacing with CORE, staff, South Pacific Division, and so on, and how that affects this process?
Yes, and one thing I will wanted to note is the one thing that's been very helpful as we've moved forward in this process of requesting this additional $25 million for the project authorization is EMWDs has had a long-standing, very successful working relationship with the Army Corps of Engineers since that 2000 authorization originally was enacted. The year in and year out, working with the L.A. District, the division in San Francisco, and also with the headquarters in Washington, D.C. And then upon receiving the funding year after year, you know, producing results has really been a benefit, and the Corps has been has become a supporter of this effort. So with that head of steam, in terms of implementing a successful project over the years, and a program over the years. The process was to first had to be done was we had to submit an application. It was about a year and a half ago to the Army Corps of Engineers, making this additional $25 million request to increase the authorization. At that stage, the application request had to be included in what's called the Corps' annual report document. Fortunately, last June, we learned that the $25 million increase of the authorization was included in that document. So we had successfully put forth the application. We also got support from our congressional delegation in sending letters to the Corps in supporting that project be included in their annual report. Second phase of that process is what I've described to you today, is now that it's in the annual report, which gives the Corps kind of the Corps stamp of approval, Congress needs to take that action and include the provision and statutory language in a Water Resources Development Act, and that's what we're going through right now. So I don't know if that answers your question, but year in and year out, we're working with the L.A. District, the division, and headquarters, and that had to be done on this reauthorization.
You really can't be successful just working with your members of Congress, and you can't be successful just working with the Corps hierarchy. You have to get them kind of in sync through this entire process. And I think Pete and Jeff and the Vanscoy team has done a great job in helping us do that.
Absolutely. As the chairman of the Natural Resources Committee in the House, has he released his water bill yet?
Yeah, so the chairman Huffman of the Water, Oceans, and Wildlife Subcommittee did release a draft reclamation comprehensive water bill a few weeks back. It's kind of an all-encompassing measure. We will be submitting comments in the coming days. We've been reviewing the language. What we've seen from the water recycling from the Title 16 side and the desalinization program side is that the bill seems to have taken existing bills, Representative Grace Napolitano's bill to reauthorize the program by $500 million over 5 years, as well as a bill by Representative Mike Levin that specifically authorizes the desalinization program for $64 million a year over 4 years. Basically took that language that has been introduced and put it into this draft bill. But there's a lot more to it. The water storage provisions are very, very tricky, and there's certainly a different approach than what we've seen Senator Feinstein and Senator Gardner take with their bill that they introduced, S-1928, which was introduced last July. In fact, tomorrow morning, AQUA is hosting a meeting at their offices that's going to include all of the key congressional staff from the committees, from the personal offices, outside stakeholders, and the main topic is to discuss to go forward on these reclamation bills, on these reauthorization bills in the House and Senate. So we'll get updates directly from the staff on what they're going to do, and then you know how we can hopefully ultimately come to a final package somewhere down the line. But it's going to be tricky. The bills are, the Huffman's approach is a lot different than we're seeing out of the Senate.
Okay. Have any other questions? Hey, I want to thank you and Jeff for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We
so
didn't
much.
Get to hear from Jeff, but
no, we weren't any more questions. It didn't stop me with any of your questions this year. Well, we appreciate it. It's been, it's 14 years that we've been representing Eastern back in Washington, and it's been a real honor and privilege to serve as your eyes and ears in the federal relations team. So we thoroughly enjoy it, and we look forward to continuing that this year.
Yeah, I just want to say that Pete and prior to Pete, it was actually Pete and Thane that started out with EMWD, and I can tell you they are highly respected on both sides of the aisle in Washington, D.C. They have a lot of respect, and
usually can get an appointment with anybody that we need to move whatever agenda we have forward. And so with the addition of Jeff and his knowledge of the staff and everything associated with basically natural resources and the word of process and Army Corps, it's a great partnership.
Well, I appreciate that, President Sullivan, and I will just add one last thing, is that EMWD is highly considered in these key water congressional committees, in the federal agencies, with amongst the Senator Feinstein's office and our House delegation. They're turned to a lot for their expertise and their opinion on federal water policy and programs. And so the hard work that Eastern does, the advocacy that you continue to do and how you prioritize this program over the years has paid dividends, and it makes our job all that much easier. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Danielle, we'll have Aaron up. with a nice introduction, I'm sure.
So with that break on our federal lobbyist side, we're happy to turn it over to our state side and have Aaron share all the intrigue that is going on in Sacramento. Aaron, again, with Numella Pappas and Associates.
Thank you, Danielle, and thank you, President Sullivan and members of the board, for the invitation this morning. Last year, I didn't bring a coat, and today I feel kind of silly that I didn't bring gloves. So, a little chillier than I remember. My colleague, Jamie Miner, whom you might all remember from the first presentation, regrets she couldn't be here today. She has a new two-month-old, so she's at home, but she's staying in touch and continues to enjoy representing the district. Thought it would be helpful to talk a little bit about landscape in Sacramento. We usually advise that it's important to understand the context in which everything you're advocating is perceived based on everything else that's going on. And with a new governor and a now three-fourths Democratic legislature, we thought that talking a little bit about how we got to where we are now and what's on the horizon would be helpful in terms of seeing how the water priorities play out in the next couple of years. So we are right now in the second year of a legislative session. More than 5,000 bills were introduced in the first year of a legislative session. About 2,600 of those moved, and now the legislators have the ability to introduce additional bills. The deadline for that is the end of February, and then they obviously have until the end of August to move those bills. Some of the things that we saw in the last year are with a Democratic governor and a legislature that has the ability to override vetoes and by one party appropriate, raise taxes, pass bonds, pass constitutional amendments, we noticed a more activist legislature, more bills, and bills that we've seen before, and we've seen prior governors veto before, have been kind of spruced up. In some cases, are even broader than they were presented in the past, and then launched to the governor to test where his tolerance is for some of these issues. So this governor in his first year actually vetoed 16% of bills, which is virtually unheard of for a Democratic governor. Jerry Brown, I think, reached that threshold in one of his years. We certainly didn't see that during the Gray Davis years. So sort of unusual, he decided to kind of draw a line in the sand. And even then, only 16% of bills were actually vetoed. So that provides another bit of context. In the first year of this governor's governorship, we didn't really see a lot of his agenda. And that isn't at all his fault. I think we actually saw more of his agenda than we usually see from a governor in the first year. First-year governors are usually saddled with the budget of their predecessors, which is prepared really behind the scenes in the August and September prior to their election. And so for this governor to begin to give some indications of where he was on state water policy during the interim before he became governor was unusual. We obviously saw some change in the tone of the state water board, particularly on the voluntary settlement agreement issue before he became governor, and those changes became more pronounced once he was governor. The state has some of the same problems we have seen, sort of endemic problems that have never, structural problems that have never been dealt with. We are in good fiscal health right now, but many of the structural issues that have plagued prior administrations dating back to the Gray Davis administration, staff then, and we all lived with the repercussions of that during the Schwarzenegger years, were not dealt with. And those are major tax structural issues. The state has volatile revenues. The state has pension obligations that have never been dealt with. Structural deficit pressures. And then in addition to that, we have a heavy reliance on federal funding for many of our health care issues, and we continue to expand coverage and benefit, and we rely on the generosity of the federal administration, which was rejected in the last week, and obviously we don't have the best relationship with the federal administration. So we anticipate that this will create significant budget pressures despite our current surplus, and those are things that this administration will have to deal with and decide to grapple with. In the first year of this governor's administration, we saw a heavy focus on infrastructure issues. Another thing the state has not dealt with outside of transportation in many, many years in any sort of comprehensive way. We have spent a lot of time changing our energy portfolio. We have not spent a lot of time and resources in investing in how we transmit energy in the state. And obviously the same can be said for water, water resilience, water storage. And because of some of the disasters we saw primarily on the energy and fire front last year, this governor has made it a huge priority, and the legislature has joined him in that, in investing, has made infrastructure investment a major priority amidst these budget pressures. And we expect that to continue. You will hear that investment talked about as resilience. Which is a way sort of saying we're looking obviously into the future and trying to mitigate the impact that natural disasters and lack of infrastructure investment and a land use policy that isn't complementary to building things in California. It is a way of saying we're beginning to deal with it, and it will take a long time to see the returns on that. Many of you probably saw that yesterday the governor began the process of indicating where he might be on voluntary settlement agreements, which is to say he is in support of them, and he sent some signals that he is not in support of the sort of protracted lawsuits we have seen under prior administrations, believing them to keep us from reaching resolution on the major issues we need to reach resolution on to make sure that water flows freely and to the parties in which it should flow. But there was also a strong tilt to the very robust environmental constituency in California. The governor started by saying we're going to double the salmon population by the year 2050. You know, my own opinion on that is that is a mechanism for the governor being able to broker conversations without the environmental community saying that he's giving their issues short shrift. So he starts with a landscape commitment, but then also tempers it with saying, I will actually help to broker these voluntary settlement agreements. So that was newsworthy. On the infrastructure bond front, on the resilience front, we have seen three separate proposals. The governor's was released in just this past weekend. His proposal is $4.7 billion in what is largely infrastructure financing, which, from my perspective, distinguishes it from prior investments in water infrastructure. We have seen one fairly robust bond in prior years, but most of California's investment, just one opinion, in water infrastructure, quote-unquote, really has been in conservation and conservation of land and parks. So it has been less on the waterfront and more on the water side and more on the resources side. And so I think we are seeing the legislature and the governor's office begin to move in the direction of supporting actual investment in infrastructure, which I think many of us believe to be a positive. The legislature has two bonds, one $3.9 billion, the other just over $4 billion, and we believe that all those parties will work to negotiate a final bond agreement for this November ballot sometime this spring, potentially preemptive of the budget itself. And the reason for that, obviously, is to allow a lot of time for the gear-up and getting it on the ballot, but also so that everybody can move on with that agenda and kind of say that it's done and we're working on it. It gives them air cover for the fire season, and it allows them to turn the page on some other issues that they want to grapple with. So we look forward to that. And then on the political front, obviously 2020 is a big election year, presidential election year, and we expect voter turnout to be high. We also have a number of vacant seats in California that are relevant to the district. The first of those, or vacant seats, or contested seats, I should say. The first of those is SD 28, which we all know to be Senator Stone's seat. Obviously, he left for a position in the Trump administration. He recently became the Western Regional Director of the Federal Labor Department. Melissa Melendez, current assembly member, is one of the candidates in that race. Small business owner John Schwab is another. The registration in that district is marginal but tilts Republican, with a 36% Republican registration versus less than 34% Democratic registration. There are three Democrats in the race, and Elizabeth Romero from Riverside, Joy Silver, who is a business person, housing advisor, and then Anna Nevenik, a nonprofit director. The general election isn't until May 12th, but given the voter registration in this district, the real election to pay attention to is the primary, in my opinion. And so it will be interesting. Obviously, the sitting assembly member could only be on one ballot. So for her to file for the Senate seat and take a risk is, a significant move on her part. So we'll have to see how that plays out, and we'll obviously keep a close eye on it. Her seat then is also up for grabs, AD 67. Normally her term would have ended in 2024, but for her decision to run in the Senate primary. The candidates, this is another seat where there is a significant Republican registration advantage, actually higher than for the Senate seat. We'll be, of course, watching the Republican candidates closely. Steve Manos, the mayor of Lake Elsinore, is on the ballot, along with the assembly member's husband, educator Nick Perdue, and then Kelly Sayarto, who is the mayor of Murrieta, And then Jeremy Smith from Canyon Lake. He's a council member. So we will be keeping close tabs on that. And then there are races in AD 42. That's the May seat, obviously the former Republican leader. He's not termed until 2026. The distinguishing thing in this race is that he's running as a no-party preference candidate, which is, you know, an unusual thing for a previously sitting Republican member and the former leader to do. And so we'll be watching that closely as well. The only other seat that we would draw to your attention is SD23. Senator Morrell, obviously Riverside and San Bernardino counties, is termed this year, and there are three Republican candidates in that race. One is Rosie Bo, Christina Parassi, and then Lloyd Wright. There are two Dems running in the seat, and this is the type of seat that, based on party registration, we think could be a contested seat in a presidential election year, and we would expect leadership, both Senate Republican and Democratic leadership, to pay close attention to the seat. The Democrats are Chris Goodfellow, who has the Democratic Party support, and then Abigail Medina, who is a San Bernardino County School Board member. So we will be keeping eyes on all of those races and let you let your folks know as things get closer to Election Day. And then finally, switching back to the policy front, we have our sponsored bill, SB 414, which continues to sit in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. It was in an unusual place. Last year, it was part of kind of the larger negotiations between the two houses on the water deal that resulted in, thankfully, no water tax. But as a result of that, many of the other policy proposals were placed on hold. We were fortunate that this bill was designated a two-year bill. Normally, bills held in the Assembly Appropriations Committee are held indefinitely. This one actually has the potential to have a hearing in August. So we will continue to be working closely with board staff and the legislative staff behind the scenes in the hopes of being able to move this bill. It's clear to us that the board has been pretty productive in their conversations, seeing this as another tool for their toolkit. And then finally, I want to echo some of the things said by my colleague, Pete. The district has an excellent reputation in Sacramento, and it does make it very easy. I'm not trying to talk myself out of work here, but it makes it very easy to represent you. And a lot of that is you bring solutions, not just complaints. You bring solutions and you bring a plan for implementing them. So, for example, last year, you know, after several years of discussion about a water tax, and you all, under your prior lobbyists, did this the year prior as well, you talked about a solution for spending revenues more effectively and doing a better job of managing water quality in the state. And that resonated with folks in Sacramento. They often hear why something doesn't work or why folks don't want to do it. They don't often hear how are you looking at the greater good and what are you contributing in the way of solutions for that. And so that's what really distinguishes you, along with the work of your general manager and your staff, to not only present that in Sacramento, but to be accurate and facile. So providing accurate information about what's going on the ground, looking forward, providing solutions, but also being facile when folks raise concerns or want to go in a different direction, being able to adapt to where they're headed. And that's what I think makes you so effective. So anyway, thank you again for the opportunity, and I'm available to take any questions.
Sure, I'll just add that, you know, Erin and her associates, having been up to Sacramento a few times, she's extremely well respected on both sides of the aisle up there, and has absolutely no problem getting into or getting access to whatever legislator needs that we need, or any one of the agencies up there that we need to work with. And a lot of the credit also goes to Danielle for being up there a lot. And it does pay off for the district because she's known as the ENWD lady in Sacramento, along with Erin and her crew. And I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Erin.
With that, let's take a 10-minute break.